Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Read and Buried podcast. I'm Frankie, and I'm delighted to be joined today by the brilliant Simon McCleave.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Nice to be here. I'm doing all right, yeah.
Good.
I've just travelled back from London to North Wales, and it's freezing cold, but otherwise we're all okay.
Yeah, you're seeing all the sights. What an exotic journey you've taken.
It is very exotic, yeah.
Yeah, God, I'm definitely done with winter at this point. Enough.
I know, yes.
Enough. Yeah. Where's this global warming I keep hearing about? It's bloody freezing.
If only.
Yeah, global cooling. Oh, but Simon, I'm so delighted to have you on. Thank you so much for coming. I've got a little bio that I'm going to read out about you that hopefully it's all correct. But feel free to tell me if anything's horribly wrong.
Right.
It's all taken from various internet sources, so I assume it's all reputable. But let's see, shall we?
Yeah.
Simon McCleave is a best-selling crime novelist. His first book, The Snowdonia Killings, was released in January 2020 and soon became an Amazon bestseller, reaching number one in the Amazon UK chart and selling over 150,000 copies. Before he became an author, Simon was a script editor at the BBC and a producer at Channel 4 before working as a story analyst in Los Angeles. Throughout his career, he's worked on films such as The Full Monty and TV series such as Silent Witness, Murder in Suburbia, Teachers, The Bill, EastEnders, and many more. His Channel 4 film, Out of the Game, was critically acclaimed and described as an unflinching portrayal of male friendship by Time Out. His new book, The Drowning Isle, is out now. It's the fourth in his Anglesey series. Did I say Anglesey right, by the way?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's a scary looking word. There's E's, there's S's, there's all sorts going on. Right. Anglesey series. I've ruined it then. And is full of Simon's trademark claustrophobia and page-turning suspense. When a teenage boy goes missing on a camping trip with his friends, the close-knit community of Anglesey is shaken. D.I. Laura Hart is brought in to lead the murder investigation and instantly feels the pressure. Not least because her colleague's son was the last to see the missing boy alive. Uh-oh. The trail leads her to discover a religious cult called the Fair Men, who have a dark history and still hold their ceremonies on the island where the boys were camping. And as Laura delves deeper into the lives of her own neighbours, it becomes clear that the island will not give up its secrets easily. Outside of writing, Simon lives in North Wales with his wife, two children, and an adorable dog named Tilly. As well as being a talented writer with a keen eye for a cracking story, Simon is also very kind, generous with his time, and a dab hand at TikTok videos.
Not sure about that. The only thing I can think of is I'm not a dab hand at TikTok videos, but I've had a dabble.
Oh, dab is dab and dabble. You put the dab into dabble. I mean that.
Indeed.
So is that all correct, apart from the dabbing?
Pretty much, yeah, it's all spot on.
Good. And wow, what a fascinating career journey you've had into crime writing. How did you end up writing about murder?
I think I'm just obsessed with murder. I'm obsessed with crime. I know, that's very dark.
No, I get it. You're in the right place.
Yeah. Ever since I was little, I think I'm just obsessed with mysteries, whodunits. Even like, you know, my first books were Enid Blyton, kind of the Famous Five and Secret Seven books. And it was like, everything was about solving mysteries, and then it was crime, and then it was gangsters or whatever it might be. So I think I just was kind of born to write crime. If someone said to me, write a sci-fi, I literally would have no idea what to do. So
open with a murder in space or something?
I guess, yes, yeah. I could do that. But I'm in the right genre, so yes. I guess that's sort of everything's been leading up to this point.
I hear in space no one can hear you scream, so...
That is true. I heard that, yeah.
And I'm really fascinated how your experience, obviously working as a script editor and a producer and even, you know, making your own films, how do you think that has influenced your crime writing?
Hugely, yeah. I think the skills I learned writing scripts are very transferable to writing fiction, novels, dialogue, pacing, scenes, characters. They're all the same apart from... The beauty of writing a novel is that you fill in the kind of blanks and you can kind of be more descriptive, but also you can talk about, which is a relief because scripts are often about what the character doesn't say. And with a book, you can fill that in. So you can say, right, the characters might be talking about a sandwich, but they're thinking this actually, what this is what's going on in their head. So I really enjoy these days writing about what characters are thinking and plotting or whatever it is. So that's the nice thing about writing novels. And the other thing I think is speed. I write a lot, but I write very quickly. And people often ask, how do you write so fast? And I think when you work in TV, especially on sort of long-running series or anything like that, you don't have any, they don't give you time to kind of like sort of have a little bit of a think. So sometimes they'll ring you up and say, right, we need to rewrite something and we're filming at 7 o'clock tomorrow. Can you rewrite this, this, and this? And you just have to do it. So I think I transferred that skill too, which means I write my novels pretty fast, which is good.
When you say pretty fast, how fast are we talking?
2 months.
That's really fast.
Yeah, that is pretty fast, isn't it?
That's impressively fast. Wow.
Yeah.
And how have you found the experience of writing, presumably working on TV scripts and things, you're in a collaborative working environment. And then with writing, it can be quite an isolated solo writing can be very different. Or have you always...
I prefer that.
People, huh? They ruin everything.
The worst thing about writing in TV was the other people. And also, when you're... Well, the thing is, I suppose... When you're writing a novel for a publisher in particular, you're the only creative force. So basically it's me and my words and that's it. Whereas when you're writing a script, you've kind of got cast, director, photography, costumes, whatever it might be. And often on long running series where there's lots of writers, you're not even, you're kind of quite low down the pecking order. And I would also say that people that work in TV are, a little bit more ego-driven and more ruthless. And my experience in publishing is that the people in publishing are so lovely and caring and nurturing and patient. I was sort of slightly taken aback when I started working in publishing because I was kind of almost concerned that everyone was too lovely. I was thinking,
what are they planning?
What's the deal here? And then I realized that as I go along, actually, that's what the world of publishing is like. So it's a refreshing change.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I say this every time I speak to an author, but the crime writing community in particular is especially welcoming and lovely, just, considering everyone talks about murder all day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And everyone's so supportive that, I sort of have lots of friends who are crime authors. And we'll just ring each other up and give us tips or ideas about how to launch a book. Or if we're going to a crime festival, everyone just kind of hangs out and drinks coffee. Chats about all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's really nice. And everyone's very supportive.
I guess the other thing as well about moving away from script writing for TV and film is that you now have an unlimited budget in your mind when you're writing a book.
Indeed.
That must be exactly. Lovely.
Helicopters. I love
so
helicopters.
Many helicopters.
I'm obsessed with helicopters. So every time there's a chase, it's like, let's get someone in a helicopter because actually there's no one going, well, we don't have a budget for that. So, or speedboats or whatever it might be. It's sort of like whatever I want, I get. So it's really nice in that way. So
No budget in the theatre of the mind.
No, indeed.
Amazing. Yeah, why not? And then explosions, get some of them in there as well.
Everything, yeah, just
set fire
to
people.
Just everything.
Huge casts of peripheral characters. Why the hell not?
Yeah, blow everything up.
Well, speaking of characters, we should talk about your brilliant new book, The Drowning Isle. And although this is the fourth in your Anglesey series, definitely still works as a standalone for people that maybe haven't read the first three. But what do you want people to come in to this book knowing or not knowing? Do you want them to go in cold or is there anything they should be?
I don't mind. I kind of think it does work as a standalone. All my books work as standalones. Mm. But I think you get more out of it. I would suggest that you get more out of it if you start at the beginning of both my series because of backstory and character. And often in both my Snowdonia series and my Anglesey series, there is a ongoing kind of arc of a story that's kind of underlying it. So with the Anglesey series, Laura Hart is the DI. Laura Hart is our main character, and her husband was a uniformed copper who is killed before the books start. He's killed in Manchester 3 years earlier, and throughout the books she investigates his murder because she believes it's to do with corruption in the Manchester police. And so that kind of threads that's ongoing throughout those books. So I kind of think it works better if you do start at the beginning. However, you can kind of catch it up. And I do sort of spend a little bit of time catching people up with what's happened. So, but yeah, no, I think, you know, most series, I mean, a lot of series are much better when you start at the beginning and work your way through and see those characters change, progress and stuff like that. So
absolutely, especially with a character like Laura, because obviously, as you've mentioned, the death of her husband, she's got a lot on her mind that I think maybe you wouldn't appreciate as fully if you haven't gone on that journey with her.
Yeah.
But how do you write? So I was actually speaking to Jane Casey about this just the other day. I find it so fascinating how you can write a book as part of a series, but get enough exposition in so that people new can come into it without shoving it down their throats from like page one. How do you balance that background information versus the, you know, enough to keep the story moving and engaging for new readers?
It is balanced. And I suppose you just have to go on your instinct about how much is enough, because clearly backstory just completely holds a book up, doesn't it? So it's like, and it's really plonky.
Yeah.
So you're kind of going, and it's like exposition, but I suppose you have to hold in your mind that enough for someone coming completely clean to it, but not too much to the people who read everything just go, oh, yeah, we know.
Yeah.
And I do get the odd email on books or saying, yeah, why do you spend so much time? When I've read, I know all this. And I'm like, well, there are people that do come to these books that have no idea at all. So
it's not all about you, specific person, turns out.
No, exactly. Readers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a balance.
Yeah. And I guess as well, with your experience in script writing, you have a real consideration for beats of a narrative and how to keep people engaged. Is that, that's obviously on your mind as you're writing your books?
All the time. Mm. I think every scene needs to change, needs to push the story and characters forward. And every scene I try and stop every scene with some kind of moment where it's like, right, now what happens? So that each chapter, you kind of go, right, now I need to know what happens, because it sort of just moves it forward. So hopefully every chapter has a beat that has some kind of jeopardy.
Yeah.
So that you're always trying to turn the page and go, right, now I need to know what happens. So hopefully they're sort of fast paced enough that that kind of keeps people going.
I'm so also very a little bit starstruck by the fact that you've worked on The Bill, because The Bill growing up was
the best,
like the best. I remember I had a signed photo of, I forget the guy's name. Is it the guy Bill Murray who was in it for years?
Yes.
I had a signed photo of Bill Murray, and that was really important to me. Yeah, of course.
Oh my God, that was my main thing. I did 40 episodes of The Bill.
Wow.
So I was always down in South Wimbledon on set and in the buildings, just writing and writing and writing. So yeah, no, so that was my big thing. Late 90s, early noughties, I was kind of a lot of episodes of The Bill.
That's amazing.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I did love it.
The Bill is iconic. And do you find you often just walk in step with your wife now, just out of habit?
the music playing in my head. Yeah, I know, exactly. And the best thing ever about The Bill is that they used to sort out, you know, ride-alongs, I think they call it days. So we used to go out with Peckham Police in the back of a squad car for the day. They would just kind of range it off and on just to kind of get research going. And we'd kind of go on like, I remember like there being a machete thing going on, which is not great. But we went down Peckham High Street about 60 miles an hour on the wrong side of the road with the blues and twos going.
Oh.
It was so exciting. And then we'd like busted a massive kind of drugs thing in this tower block. Most of the time they were going, stay in the car, we're locking the car. And I was like, no, I want to get out.
Yeah. Like, we're going to bust them. We are going to bust them.
Yeah, I'm going to help you.
Yeah.
But, so that's great, because that learning experience has kind of informed my writing ever since. So I still remember what it was like going out in a squad car in Peckham, bombing around, and the kind of adrenaline rush as well.
Yeah, that's so cool.
And I could really see that thing where when you came home from being out as a police officer and coming home to something kind of as mundane as a home, that you were kind of going, where's the buzz? You'd just be still kind of high.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a real insight into being a sort of police officer. It was great.
You basically were a police officer, I think we can.
I was,
basically.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
You should have had a badge.
Yeah, you should have made your own badge to take on the ride-alongs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, missed opportunity, never mind. So do you think The Bill has influenced particularly your approach to procedural kind of writing?
Yeah, completely. I think it's that there's a real balance to be struck between writing something that feels authentic and writing something that is authentic. So, and I take lots of shortcuts. However, I do, I have a friend who's a detective sergeant in Wrexham Police Station, and often I will ring him up and say, okay, we're going to do this search and they're going to find this, or they're going to arrest this guy, and how can we make this work? So he'll kind of give me some advice, pushing the boundaries a little bit,
yeah,
but enough that it feels real. And sometimes it's just, you know, I don't want procedure to get in the way of a really good story.
Mm.
But what I do want is that people read it and go, yeah, that feels right. I know Jed Mercurio, who's like, you know, the guy that does Line of Duty,
yeah,
brilliant at it. Because I know, you talk to a police officer, they'll go, it's all nonsense.
What he writes feels real, though.
But it does feel real.
Yeah.
So he has that real knack of using, you know, acronyms and all that kind of stuff to make it feel real. However, it's quite a long way from it. But when you watch Line of Duty, you do feel that it's authentic. And I suppose I'm going for that kind of that idea that when you read it, you think this could really happen.
Yeah, especially in interrogation scenes and things.
Oh, like, I love those.
Oh, me too. Favorite. Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, good old TV, police procedural. So thank you for bringing it to my life with The Bill, because as I say, when I was out, I watched, I think I never missed an episode of The Bill. I'm so sad it's not on anymore.
Very excited.
Yeah, very much so. But going back to your book anyway, sorry, it's like a Bill tangent. With this story, where did the inspiration come from? I mean, obviously, landscapes play a huge part in your writing.
Yes.
And so was that the inspiration for this story?
Trying to think. I mean, the landscapes of Anglesey. Anglesey's beautiful. It's absolutely stunning.
Yes.
And so I guess that is the kind of like, that's why I chose to set the series there. Because it's very different to Snowdonia, even though they're literally just, you know, they're very, very close to each other. I actually think that I've got a daughter who's 20, and sort of hearing shenanigans about other of my friends' kind of teenage boys going off on camping trips and getting into sort of mischief or taking drugs or drinking, all that kind of stuff. I just kind of went, there's something interesting about 4 18-year-old boys going off on a little camping trip, and then one of them just vanishes while they're all high on sort of mushroom chocolate. That's basically how it works.
Yeah.
And like, well, and I went, what would happen if they came back and went, we've lost him, we don't know where he is? And I suppose that for me was like the kind of starting point. I was like, yeah, so then I have to work out what did happen to him and why. But that kind of idea, I just popped into my head, and I just thought, well, that's a really good starting point for a police procedural. So
very much so. And I, as you're interested in crime, I imagine, and it probably explains it, why there's a cult in there. Cults are fascinating, right?
Yes.
And
yeah.
What kind of approach did you have to researching religious cults? Or did you kind of take a, you know, or did you not? What was your approach to writing about the Fair Men?
Just read around it loads. And also, Anglesey's the druid centre of the whole UK.
Yes. That's so
cool. So I kind of went, and the island, there's an island off of the island. So Anglesey's an island, but there's a tiny little island off of there that is kind of accessible most of the time, but it had, it's got a Celtic cross on there and an ancient church that goes back to 600 AD. And the druids go on there to kind of perform like sunrise ceremonies. And I just went, oh, this stuff's amazing. It's brilliant. And so the kind of more research, sometimes the research kind of like then leads it. So I just went, that's brilliant. And I found out about different druid sects that kind of splinter off from each other. And I don't know, all that stuff. I just kind of went, this is all great. This is all great material for a kind of dark, spooky crime thriller.
Very much. A question I actually kind of ask a lot of the authors I speak to who, you know, from the research, is it very difficult sometimes to pick up bits of research and then not be able to use them? Or is there anything that you think, oh, I wish I could have included that? Or have you included everything you wanted to include from your research?
Normally, yeah. Some stuff doesn't work. Mm. Stuff I have to invent and hope that no one goes, hang on a second, that's not true.
It's fiction. Get over it, people.
It's fiction, I know. Get over it. But mainly, yes. No, mainly I do get to kind of use it. Actually, I mean, the best thing about it is that sometimes there's a couple of books I've written where, because often when I write a book, I know the beginning and I know the end, but I don't always know the middle bit.
Ah.
And so I kind of, for me, it's about joining the two together in a kind of interesting way about covering the tracks. But a couple of times I've been on the journey and done some research and the middle bit has not gone the way I thought it was going to go. But I found, because I actually research, I found something far more interesting
to take it in a different
direction. So that's really exciting. I had a book where there was, And I found out about a recording studio that was in North Wales that was very kind of was used by Fleetwood Mac and Pink Floyd and other loads of other kind of really cool bands in the 70s and 80s. And there was a scandal around teenage girls going up there and drugs and booze and all sorts of shenanigans. And as soon as I started researching, I went, that's brilliant. I'm going to use that because that was not in the book.
Wow.
So I ran with that. So that was great.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. And actually, this ties in nicely to a question I like to ask all the authors that I speak to, is the writing process. You've touched on it a bit with your incredible speed with which you turn books around. But what do you enjoy most and least about the writing process?
What I like most is coming up here with a coffee. I put my headphones on and I normally have a soundtrack playing. So at the moment, I'll either listen to like the Broadchurch soundtrack or Mayor of Easttown or
instrumental stuff then.
So basically really dark, creepy music, no lyric, no vocals. Yeah. And then I start to write and then I'm lost. And then I normally do about an hour. And normally that kind of takes me to about 800 to 1,000 words if I'm flying.
In an hour. Wow.
Then I'm a bit knackered.
Understandably.
But that's the best bit, is that just getting lost to the point where I can kind of sort of come, it sounds a bit kind of, but cheesy, but I sort of come to almost like I've been in the book, I could be anywhere.
Wow.
That's the best bit. The worst bit, just some of the stuff you have to do, like
this podcast.
No, I love doing podcasts.
Oh, okay. joking.
But getting notes back from my editor. I always have a tantrum for 24 hours because I always think my first draft is perfect.
Of course.
And then I read the notes and go, oh, yeah, okay, this does make my book much better. But to be fair, actually, there aren't many downsides to it, really.
You're in the right career.
I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky. So, yeah, no, it's a really, well, it's basically a hobby that I get paid to do, which is it's a pretty good deal, isn't it, really?
You're living the dream. That's amazing.
I am living the dream.
But it sounds
I'm very
like
lucky.
It's not luck, though. It sounds like you've earned it. Obviously, you've worked very hard for a very long time and you're a talented writer. So it's all worked out. So
maybe. I don't think myself
maybe.
As a writer,
but... Oh, come on. You're obviously pretty good. You've been doing.
I think I'm all right.
Yeah. After how many years you've got to all right. That's pretty, yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the humble nature of writers I find so fascinating, which actually leads me on to another question I like to ask, which is, what's a line that you've written lately or across your catalogue that you're especially proud of?
Yeah.
some people struggle with this one.
I think it has to be, in my Snowdonia series, the main character is D.I. Ruth Hunter.
Yeah.
And she's like a South Londoner, quite Cockney, moved up to North Wales, and she smokes. She still smokes cigarettes, which in these day and age is not okay. And what she says to her sergeant, who's Nick, she goes, "You drive, I'll smoke." And it's their little catchphrase. And basically every time when they're in the CID, it's like to the point where actually people quote it back to me when I go to Q&A.
That's amazing.
Someone told me I should have that put on a mug because it's like, how it works is the scene goes and they're like, oh, we need to go. Oh my God, something's happened. We need to dash out. And she'll chuck him the car keys and she'll say, "You drive, I smoke." So that's their catchphrase. So I think I quite like that.
If not a mug, a key ring, a car key ring,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course.
That's that works really well. You should definitely, or an ashtray, I guess, a travel ashtray. Do they make those?
Yeah.
Or this is good. I'm going to
T-shirt. Do,
or a sleeve that you can put your cigarettes in that hide all the horrible pictures of cancerous lungs. And then you can pop that over.
Better.
There you go. Yeah.
Merch.
That's what you're missing. That's the next step. So.
That is.
And when you're obviously, you are a very fast and prolific writer, which is incredibly impressive. Do you ever get writer's block?
No.
Really?
I'm touching wood because it hasn't happened to me.
Sure. Well, that's amazing. Never in your whole book writing life.
I don't know why.
Wow.
I don't really want to question why because
Let's
I don't
not.
Like to, but, no. But while I'm writing one book, the idea for the next book pops into my head and I sort of find myself drifting. As I'm finishing one book, I'm already planning the next one in my head. I don't know. I mean, that sounds really weird, but that is how it works.
Wow. And so you're able to kind of compartmentalize and focus on multiple stories in your head at the same time.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I've just been writing two books simultaneously in the last three weeks, which I don't recommend, but because of deadlines, it was like, yeah, that was difficult, but we're nearly there now.
two books, the same kind of massive word counts for each at the same time?
Yeah, both 80,000 and completely. One was a psychological thriller set in Tuscany, and one was the 18th book in my Snowdonia series set in Chester with a serial killer.
Wow.
Yeah. My head is about to explode, but I've finished the Chester one and I got a week to finish the other one and then I'm done and I'm having a break.
Oh, I think that's a really good idea that you have a break.
Like in a dark room.
Yeah, for like a month or something.
Yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, you've earned it. Jesus. Wow. Okay. So with all of this, you obviously work incredibly hard and you do a hell of a lot of writing. Do you have much time to read?
No.
Yeah. I was going to say, when would you?
I used to read lots.
Yeah.
And obviously the other thing is that when I spend my whole day in front of a laptop reading fiction, my own fiction, I don't always want to, I do read. I mean, it's not like I don't read, but it's often I kind of want to just settle down in front of Netflix or whatever it is. And the only thing that is kind of weird is that I watch police procedurals religiously. My family will say, haven't you just spent the whole day writing scenes like this, like, you know, in front of the crime scene board in the CID room? And I'll say, yeah, but this is my idea of relaxing. So it's very weird.
You're clearly in the right world. You're in the right industry. Well, yes. You love it.
Exactly.
Yeah. What have you been watching lately? What's been helping you switch off, but not because you're still in the police procedural world?
That thing with Jodie Foster, which I now completely forgotten.
True Detective.
True Detective.
Yeah.
Yeah, although I'm not sure. I loved the first one. I thought that was amazing. This one started really well. I'm sort of losing it a little bit of a thread with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, all right. Huge fan of Unforgotten with them. That was great. I'm trying to think what else I've been watching. Oh, Griselda.
I've not seen that yet. Is it good?
Trashy, but great.
Nice.
It's just like, it's not as good as Narcos, but it is brilliant. And it's just really good fun to watch. So, yeah.
That's what you want when you've been writing, you know, 10,000 words wherever in the space of a minute. You probably want to switch off with a bit of fluffy trash fun for the brain.
Yeah. Trashy crime is always good.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Wow. Okay. So I was going to ask, what was the last book that you read and loved?
Oh, I'm trying to think. I read a James Ellroy book quite recently, which I thought was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like a really old book. It's called My Dark Places.
Oh,
I mean, I've always loved James Ellroy.
Yeah.
And he's such an amazing writer. But he wrote a book about, it was a GQ article that he got commissioned to write because his mother was murdered in 1954 when he was very little in Los Angeles. And she went out to a bar to meet somebody and she was found. And he used this article as a way of reinvestigate. So, but he contacted the LAPD officers that had worked on that case, who are now retired, and they got together and they tried to reinvestigate the case. And he wrote a book about that, but then that turned into almost like an autobiography.
Wow!
So it's sort of, and it's amazing. It's just about what the impact of that is on him. That's obviously why he became a writer, but also reinvestigating the case with these guys as well. It's a really It's a very powerful piece of writing. And I just remember, I mean, I could not put it down. It was amazing.
Wow. I've not read enough of him. I read his book on the Black Dahlia, which I loved as well. Yeah, incredible. Yeah. Do you find that you kind of veer more towards nonfiction when you do read, just to keep the kind of fiction line separate or not?
Well, I suppose, yes. I guess at the moment I'm researching something that I have to read lots of nonfiction about, sort of Welsh nationalism, which doesn't sound very interesting, but it will lead to something that is interesting. I don't know. Sometimes I just kind of grab. Normally, I try and, because I've been writing a psychological thriller, I just grabbed loads of psychological thrillers that I thought were in the same genre, like Gone Girl and Girl on the Train and stuff. And I just read all those to kind of get an idea. So sometimes I'll read lots of stuff that's in the same genre. So it just varies on sort of what I'm doing at that point.
That's really interesting. And Welsh nationalism does sound very interesting, actually, because it's not something you hear a lot about. Maybe in Wales, you probably do hear more about it than we would maybe in Britain.
No, it's a true story about, I don't know if you know, that King Charles, as he is now, when he was invested as Prince of Wales in North Wales in the late 60s, there was a plot by Welsh nationalists to blow him and the whole royal family up and assassinate them.
Wow, I did not know that.
So I think it's a good story.
That is a good story. I'm guessing they didn't succeed.
No.
Spoiler.
Yeah, still. It's like Day of the Jackal, basically. And I kind of went, it's like the sort of Welsh Day of the Jackal. So I'm working on that at the moment.
Oh, that
as well.
Sounds great. That sounds really fun. And you can get Dominic West to play Prince Charles because he's already done it.
Oh, yes, of course.
There you go. What flattering perfect casting is that? Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, indeed.
Oh, boy. Wow. Simon, I'm having such a lovely time chatting to you, but unfortunately, I now have to confront you with, with something pretty bad that you've done. It's always a bit awkward when I have to do this on the podcast, but
okay.
I'm afraid that, you know what I'm talking about, Simon. You've committed a terrible, heinous crime, haven't you?
Have I?
You have. So terrible, so shocking and heinous in nature that unfortunately you have been sentenced to death.
Oh, God.
Ugh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Bit of a bummer, really, yay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What crime do you think you've committed to get to this point?
Well, it would have to be a murder of somebody that I buried, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean,
I'm basically an expert in how to get rid of dead bodies.
That is a useful skill to have, but clearly not successful because you've been caught. And I don't know what happened there. Maybe you didn't have enough coffee. You
DNA.
It's always DNA, isn't it?
It's always DNA these days.
Oh, my God. I think about all of the people who are sweating at home as 23andMe guess grows in size, you know, yeah, just like, oh, man, like. Would have got away with it too if it wasn't for your pesky DNA kits. Okay, so you've committed a murder and and it was so bad that they brought the death penalty to Wales. And
oh my God.
I know, I'm shocked because you seem very nice.
Well,
not that nice. But the good news is, although you are going to be sentenced to death, yikes, I can get you the death row meal of your dreams.
Oh, excellent.
So it's not all bad.
No.
Quite nice, actually. So what would your death row meal be?
Death row meal? Oh, God. something really, it's really kind of like, I'm trying to think. Can I have a prawn cocktail? I'm going to go very kind of like 70s.
Ooh, okay. 70s dinner party.
I'm going prawn cocktail thing at the beginning and then like a really good steak, fries, mushrooms, and then some kind of really big dessert like sticky toffee pudding. There you go.
Okay. I have more questions because I love food. How is your steak being cooked?
Medium rare.
Nice. Do you want a sauce or anything with that or just keep it steaky?
No, I don't know. Don't interfere with the meat, the sauce. No, that makes no sense.
I agree. You're a purist. I respect that. And then with the dessert, with your sticky toffee pudding, cream, custard, ice cream, what are we doing?
Ice cream.
Ice cream. Vanilla?
Yep.
Sometimes people go a bit off-piste. So, you know, they'll have like a salted caramel. I'm like, that's too many caramels.
Oh, no, that's too silly.
Mm. And one last question about the sticky toffee pudding.
Go on, then.
I know, because a friend of mine takes it very seriously and she gets very upset if it's made with dates, even though that's the traditional way to make a sticky toffee pudding. Yeah, it's using dates. Ooh. But do you have a preference or just whatever?
No, whatever. But I'm quite like the idea of dates. I might try that.
Yeah, I think that's how they used to do it to get the kind of toffee stickiness. It's one of your five a day, possibly.
Sort of.
Okay. Well, that is a great menu. And anything to drink with that? Obviously, a soft beverage of choice or just
probably
water?
Just a Coke Zero.
Coke Zero. Okay. I can get that for you. That's pretty within the realms of possibility. Fantastic. So you've had your meal. You're feeling good, but unfortunately, as good as one can on the last day of their life.
On death row, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But unfortunately, you are now dead.
Right.
Sorry. You've had a good run, and but more good news. So
excellent.
I can bury you personally with the book of your choice.
Oh, okay.
So, what book would you be buried with? You see, it's called Red and Buried, the podcast, Simon. You see what I did there?
Yeah, I see what you did there. Yeah. Sneaky.
Thank you.
what book am I being buried with? I will be buried with Graham Greene's The Human Factor.
Ooh, I haven't read that. What is it about?
It's about spies in the early 70s who are then a couple who are spies and working for MI6, and they're uncovered and people come to get them and they have to go on the run. But it's beautifully written, and it's also one of those books that I read I'm about 21 and I've read it about three times now. It's one of those books I read when I went, I want to write books. I want to write fiction. And although it took me a long time to get there, it was just, I kind of went, that's the book that kind of made me want to be a writer, really.
Wow.
So I think it seems fitting that can go in my coffin. So, yeah, that sounds good.
That's a good choice. I can pop that in there for you.
Great.
And one last kind of question that you've probably answered 100 times, but as somebody that's obviously had an incredible career in writing, What piece of advice would you give to aspiring writers, either for TV or for books? Is there one thing?
Write and write and write more. Just keep writing and show people. That's the other thing is, because the two things I've got is, I'll get people at Q&As or at festivals, people come out and say, I've got this brilliant idea for a novel. And I say, oh, how much have you written of it? And they'll say, well, I haven't written any of it.
That's not what counts, isn't it?
Well, that's not going to work, is it?
Yeah.
Because it's like lots of people have really great ideas. It's about the idea of just getting on and writing it. So I would say do that. And also don't be afraid to show people. I know it's really difficult when you first start writing to go, even if it's your mum or whatever it is, or your wife or your husband, just go get people to read it and just keep doing it.
That is a big challenge for a lot of people. I'm guessing after working in TV for as long as you have, you must have, apart from your 24-hour tantrum after you get your notes back, you must have a pretty thick skin at this point for editing.
Yes. Yeah, you do have to develop that. And the only way of developing that is basically getting people to read it and taking a deep breath and being grown up and going, okay, I don't like criticism, but that's what's going to happen. So yeah, I just keep doing it.
Yeah. Especially because it doesn't stop after you've written a book, because then you have all of the reviews and you have the
exactly. The well, I don't read my reviews anymore.
Do you not?
But no.
No, I don't blame
unless
you.
Unless someone sends me something and says, this is a great review.
Yeah.
And then I'll read it. But obviously on Amazon, I can have 100 great reviews and one bad one. And of course, I can only remember the one bad one.
Oh,
and then I.
Yeah, of course.
So don't read them. That's what I say.
More good advice. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, Simon, it's been such a pleasure to chat to you. Thank you so much. I'm sorry I had to kill you.
I know, well.
But hopefully I can dig you up in the future and you can come back on to talk about one of your other brilliant 500 books you're writing it right now at the same time. That would be
great.
Fantastic. I will get the shovel ready to resurrect you very soon. And where can people follow you online?
Website is simonmcleod.com. And if you sign up, to my VIP list, you get 2 free novellas. So, to start you off. So, yeah, have a go on that.
And I also recommend following Simon on TikTok for the dabbling that he has.
The dabbling and Facebook and Instagram as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. How fantastic.
Oh, you're very kind. And thank you to everyone who's listened. I'll be back soon with another episode. But before then, actually, Simon, one last thing. I never know how to end an episode of this podcast.
Okay.
How shall we end this?
I don't know. How should we end
it? Well, I'm asking you.
A murder.
Okay. Theatre of the mind.
Indeed.
Perfect.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while revelling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule wherever you get your podcasts.